This time on the show, hunting for something versus creating from scratch. There is always something you want people to focus on. And let's use the one without the hairy arm in the corner. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show recorded live at the Ann Arbor District Library, lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, comics.aadl.org. And this is the show where we talk about making comics, visual storytelling, the lifestyle of being a creative person, all the stuff that surrounds this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jerzy Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist. And with me today for the 2015 schedule kickoff is a buddy of mine. We're buddies, aren't we?
Yeah.
We go bowling together.
Bowling team, yeah. You're the captain.
That still cracks me up every time we talk about it. It's a Peter Baker. Baker. PeterBaker.net. Photographer. Designer. NASA enthusiast.
Mm-hmm. Disappointed NASA enthusiast.
We'll talk about that in a second. But designer, like photographer, we know generally what that means. Like, you hold up a camera, you point at a thing, you take a picture of the thing. We'll talk in detail about what really goes into that. But when you're a designer, what does that mean? Like, oh, you do some stuff in Adobe Illustrator or what?
It can be a huge range of things. It's everything from writing to visual sort of narrative and layout to branding, incorporating photography, incorporating text. Really, it's communication, mm-hmm. visual communication.
So we've actually worked together on some projects where we were actually creating characters for branding, but then you also can do like general branding of like creating like a visual style to communicate like a feeling or essence of a thing.
Yeah. So, you know, everything from advertising design where you're going to, you know, primarily be selling something to, you know, there are numerous commercial artists who are also, you know, illustrators and fine art, you know, print sellers and things like that. So runs the gamut.
And when we say you're a photographer, let's establish your cred here. You got some cred. This is pretty good. You worked for Bloomberg Business Week, mm-hmm. worked for Country Living, Popular Mechanics. That's pretty mm-hmm. cool. National Geographic Traveler, ESPN Magazine, and whole bunch of other things. That's all you can find out your whole CV on PeterBaker.net, right?
Yeah.
So, I, before we dive into the comparative thing between photography and comics, because what inspired me actually for this discussion was we were at a local Ann Arbor do-gooder event, and we were like posting like it was like this on-commerce thing where we're posting like potential talks or discussions, and like I wrote comics on the wall, and you wrote photography, and then we turned to this whole thing of like, well, nobody wants to do a photography one because all that is like just pointing a magic box at a thing and snapping a picture, and you're like, whatever, you could draw whatever you want, you don't have to deal with the confines of reality. It's like, that's a discussion, but we could talk about the NASA thing a little bit because I'm a bit of a NASA nerd too. Yep. Been to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum several times. Went to the Annex on purpose, you know, and you know, geeking out over John Young's comb. Did you see that? Like they had like his toothpaste and stuff. Like, wow, that's his little toothpaste. Yep. So you know, can we pull up the photos that you can find on Pete's site with the. Your trip to Florida.
Yeah, so a little background on it. This was one of the last shuttle launches. This was the Endeavor, or Columbia was second to last. And a buddy of mine, Justin Ouellet, who's a really, really great photographer in New York, both space nuts, neither of us had ever been to a launch. So we're like, this is the time to go. Let's not even try to go to the very last one because that's, you know, it's going to be impossible. Let's go to the second last one, turn it into a whole thing. Part of what really interested us about it was not just the space program, but the sort of community that had been built around the space program. You know, the area of Florida that Cape Canaveral is in is called the Space Coast. Like banks and credit unions and grocery stores, they're Space Coast Credit Union. Like they have taken this on, and it's really like part of their personality and their the persona of the area.
Yeah.
The high school is Astronaut High School. I mean, it's just
crazy.
It's pervasive. It's throughout. And so we were really interested in like what is that going to mean when you basically take the identity of an entire area that's been, you know, going since the Wright stuff, and, you know, take it out of there. Like,
and so abruptly too, right?
Right,
right?
Right.
This isn't like what happened in Detroit with the auto manufacturing, yeah, yeah. Like, where it was a very, very gradual thing. Maybe it didn't feel gradual to people who were experiencing it, but like this is like, oh, guess what? Tomorrow.
By the way, it's scrap now.
Yeah, there's no more.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, there is still, you know, stuff going on there. They are still doing commercial launches for satellites and stuff, but it's just not the same as the shuttle program. You know, the shuttle program was the iconic space space element of my childhood, of a lot of people's childhood.
And for a long time,
too. For a long time, 30 years.
I mean, like, yeah, Project Gemini was what, a year?
Right. Yeah, the whole Apollo program ran, you know, for less than 20 years.
Yeah.
And the space shuttle, I mean, this was an icon. Like, and the Apollo program, you know, the rockets changed. Like, there was no single sort of silhouette. The shuttle program had the same space plane, basically, for 30 years. And I mean, it was incorporated into movies, everything from Space Camp to, I don't even know what else. Even Transformers.
Well, we were just talking about that.
Yeah,
we were just talking about, like, there's two Transformers who were space shuttles. Yeah. There's a GoBot named Spacey who was a Transformer,
right.
Or who was a space shuttle, right?
There was a space shuttle something for everything.
Yeah,
there was a
right.
version of the space shuttle for every iconic, you know, childhood toy growing up. So, I mean, it really was a hugely inspirational thing for so many people. And then all of a sudden they're just like, nah, not anymore. And, you know, I get it. There's whether or not the program itself made sense anymore.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, it was like huge gut check to so many people. Just and especially around Cape Canaveral and Titusville.
So was that palpable when you were down there?
Oh, it was dank with dreariness. I mean, it was just sad. Like it was really similar to, I mean, it was very similar to Detroit, and the way you could just feel that, you know, the air sucked out of the room.
Oof.
And you know, not that things in Titusville have been, you know,
great recently, but
all the way, because the program's been dwindling for years.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still just, you know, given up, because now all of a sudden, like overnight, all the places that had, you know, shuttle themes to it were now a bygone era. Like,
right.
They were immediately in the past. So
right.
All the, even like there were comic book shops, there were bars, all these things that were named astronauts or shuttle something. Immediately, they're like, oh, that's that old thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's what I noticed when I was looking at your photography, that you, the pictures you took, is that there's all of these like really corny like astronaut statues outside of stores and like a space shuttle in the marquee.
Yep.
And when I looked at it, it had like, it instantly carried this sadness to it, like the way when you see like an abandoned merry-go-round, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
like that
exactly.
kind of like
exactly.
This was once a joyous, campy thing. Like when it's alive. It maybe can be, but it feels like there's a spirit of joy around it. But
right.
when it's abandoned, it just looks really, really sad and
yeah.
broken.
And it was a tourist draw. Like, it was
yeah.
a major tourist draw. So even places that had nothing to do with it, there was a jewelry shop that had an astronaut statue standing outside with a bunch of chains hanging over it. It was like everyone is co-opting this for their own uses, which everybody does around Disney World or anything else too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Florida. Like, they know tourism, so
yeah.
that was their thing. But it just, when it was a science-based, space-based government program that was the tourism draw, there's something really special about that.
Yeah.
When it's not, you know, Mickey Mouse or Cedar Point or something, it was an inspiring tourism draw that is just
So the reason I bring this up, and I'm so glad you spoke to it so well, Pete, because this is, you just like sort of did in microcosm, like this whole demonstration of what a visual storyteller does. You identified the symbolism, you identified the iconography, and then you made the connections to the context and the surroundings and the environment and pulled together a narrative out of this whole thing. And you can find all the photos on website peterbaker.net.
Yep.
And also you did an Ignite talk on this.
Yeah, so the second part of the story is we go down there for a whole week, you know, shooting around, like talking to people, just getting pictures of the things. There's, you know, there's all these people sort of coming out of the woodworks, people who had worked in the space program for years before, and they're all coming around to see this thing. And so Justin and I, the morning of the launch, we get up ungodly early. hike out to this causeway, which is the best place you can see without credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Best place to see it from. We had rented this ridiculous camera lens, this 800 millimeter camera lens that, you know, we were as close as we were ever going to get. We were perfect situation. 2 hours from launch, all of a sudden we hear over this bullhorn. But before we hear it from the bullhorn, we hear all these people going, "Oh." They're like, what? What's going on? And they had scrubbed the launch for some really obscure mechanical thing. And we're like, all right, well, maybe, you know, let's just keep an eye on it. Maybe it'll go up later. And like, but, you know, with a space shuttle launch, if there's some mechanical thing, they're not doing it. If it was a window or a weather window kind of thing.
Right.
So we stuck around for a couple more days and it just got less and less likely. And then they were finally like, we don't even know when this is going to go. And so I was we both came back. My wife was actually a month shy of 9 months pregnant. So I couldn't really stay in Florida on this, you know, Don Quixote quest of seeing a space shuttle launch. So we were like, well, maybe we'll make it to the last one. Maybe we will go to Discovery. And we come back. I saw the final space shuttle launch from the doctor's office during my wife's labor.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was worth it.
Yeah.
But still one of those brutal realizations that
you
never
want
to see that.
You go through all that. You want that exclamation point on
yes.
the end, right?
But yeah. at the same time, it actually made for a fairly perfect sort of poignant, you know, end chapter to the whole thing. The whole thing was disappointing. You know, I mean, we were bummed if it did go off. We were bummed. We were, you know, depressed if it didn't. So, like, the whole thing, like, there was nothing happy about the whole situation. Seeing that go off would have been like, oh, great. We got that last photo, finally. But, you know, the other 99% of it was really about the rest of the, you know, disappointing Florida stuff. And so I suppose it's, you know, serendipitous that we never got that. So that's why my Ignite talk was Florida, space, and disappointment. Those three things now are all tied together.
But you set up fireworks
we
on
did,
the beach.
Yeah, the closest we got was a big rocket. You can get big rockets in Florida. So we got a big fireworks rocket and shot it off on the beach.
Oh, but that's great. I mean, it's like, so you're a guy who thinks a lot about visual storytelling, and I'm wondering if we could maybe just want to throw out this whole like argument about like photography versus comics, because
That was just to get people to watch.
Yeah, that's how the car dealers get you to come in. Only $1.99 a month.
Yeah,
but like, because I was also looking at your website and I noticed that you have things set up to where all your galleries scroll horizontally,
mm-hmm.
and the galleries are arranged by like. Sort of like subject groupings. So like you have like the NASA story in a grouping on there. And so I'm scrolling through. I'm like, he's telling a story. This is comics. He's telling the story. It wasn't just like, here's the photos in the order I took them.
Right.
There's like highs and lows like in that gallery as I'm scrolling and scrolling and scrolling.
Sequencing and editing is a huge part of photography, especially, you know, books have become a really big deal in photography again. For a while, you know, book publishing was sort of languishing. Not a lot of photographers were putting out photo books. Now everybody is. Self-printed books, mainstream published books. And so sequencing and that sort of narrative is becoming or has become really important again. It's not just, you know, it's sort of like covers versus the books. You know, I have plenty of photos that would only apply as a single, you know, standalone sort of cover.
Yeah.
But I really feel good when I'm able to develop something longer.
So are you thinking about that when you're firing off your shots? Are you thinking about like, oh, I just shot this 10 minutes ago. This will go really well with that. Or is this a thing where you have to put all the photos on a table and look at them and figure out where the connections are?
Sometimes both. You know, if I had like obviously Florida, some of the other stuff, I'll have an idea in mind first and I seek out certain things and try to link photos, you know, through some element from what I was shooting, find some thread through other things I'm shooting and kind of have something in mind as I'm going. But at the same time, I also just – I like producing single images that look, you know, look really interesting and dynamic too. So.
All right. Can we dive into squishy questions then?
Yeah.
I'll zigzag all over the place because, like, this is one of the things, like, you know, I mean I do this exercise with my students where because like one of the things about comics that makes it very daunting is it's an advantage and a disadvantage in that I can, if I want to show a three-quarter downshot into a room, I can lift the ceiling right off of the place, and I can show a really mathematically unrealistic interpretation of that room in order to be able to stage all my elements and everything. Yeah. But it still means that I got to map out three-point perspective. I got to draw whatever kind of like, oh, there's a Danish modern coffee table in there. Crap, I got to draw that, right? And like, they got this kind of sofa and that kind of sofa. So a lot of my students, like when they're approaching visual storytelling, they'll be very daunted by the fact that they have to like draw all this stuff before they've even thought about what their shots are going to be. So I send them off on a walk. I'm like, go for a walk, take a digital camera, take a phone camera, it doesn't matter. And go for a walk in your favorite place where you just feel at ease and relaxed. And whenever something makes you say, ah, don't overthink it, just grab a picture of it. And they come back and we look at all their photos and like I, as the instructor, try to go like, okay, well, here's what I'm noticing that you're doing. Maybe you can take that to your comics. Like, you're doing a lot of really extreme close-up stuff. You're really interested in texture and shadow and structures. Okay, so we'll apply that. You are really interested in depth and staging. And put that in. So, but the thing is that in that lesson, I'm telling them whenever something makes you go, ah, grab that photo.
Uh-huh.
So I'm curious if you've ever tried to reverse engineer or if it's even dawned on you, like, when you're saying, ah, the thing, like, I'm arrested, I need to grab this. Like, what makes... what's going on in your head and what's going on around you when you say, this is the shot that I need to take?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say I think it through that much as I'm doing it. You know, the thing I love about photography is the exploratory nature of it. It's like I, you know, to some extent only identify a shot once I see it. You know, it's like I'm not a studio photographer. I'm not creating sets. I'm not crafting an image. I'm looking for it. You know, I'm more hunting for something versus creating it from scratch. You know, that said, I know usually what I'm looking for, even if I haven't thought it through from a compositional angle or something like that. I know the kind of things that I'm most interested in. I know where to find them or where maybe I should start at. So it's definitely different. I mean, you know, going back to the photographers versus comic artists for a minute, it's you know, I'm jealous in a way for the ability to create whatever it is. The tearing the roof off, that's a perfect example. You know, that's simply not a photograph you're going to be able to take.
Right.
You can create it. You know, there's actually a couple great photographers who do whole room shots from above. And they do it through like assembling a ton of photos into, and it basically becomes illustrative at that point.
Wow. They're
just capturing the elements and then they illustrate it. And it's amazing the way they're able to match the perspective and stuff like that. I don't do that. And I think a lot of that comes from, you know, having shot film for so long, and I simply couldn't afford to shoot tons and tons of photos. So I almost edited before shooting, you know. Now it's really it's amazing to be able to shoot 500 photos in an afternoon.
So you are shooting digitally now?
Quite a bit more. I still, once in a while, I'll go out on a very specific, you know, project that I just feel like it would be worth shooting large format film or something. I'll do that, but really it's become almost all digital for me.
And, well, the technology's probably caught up, I would imagine, at this point.
Yes and no. I mean, they're up to a certain sensor size. You know, if you get into medium format digital, it's very close to medium format film. Nothing matches large format film. 4 inches by 5 inches, 8 inches by 10 inches. I brought a Alex Soth book. He shoots almost nothing but 8x10 film. They're the fidelity, the richness of them, the color depth is, you know, it's still unmatched.
Okay.
But I'm not shooting that stuff. So the benefits, you know, of digital, being able to shoot so many and then being able to tease out the thread between them is really helpful.
Let me dig at this hunting thing you talk about. So, like, you're hunting for something rather than creating from scratch. Is this hunting thing, is it always a joyous activity, or are there times where it's like, crap, I'm not getting anything today? Like, nothing is, like, coming through this lens that makes any sense to me.
Oh, that happens all the time.
Okay.
You know, I'm totally bummed out about about photos I shoot constantly, but I usually don't notice that until later. So in the act of doing it, I'm having a great time wandering around somewhere I'm not supposed to be, or just, you know, outside bumming around.
when you're doing all those Detroit photos, you got a lot of photos of Detroit.
Yeah.
And you post a lot on your Instagram. People should follow you on Instagram as Peter Baker on Instagram. Yeah. So you're not, you're like, just like.
Just, oh, yeah. That's, I, yep. Just wandering.
That's
wandering
awesome.
Street, wandering the streets like a hobo, you know, getting photos that pop up in front of me. But, you know, Detroit's a tough case because you don't want to. You know, I'm trying not to specifically shoot. I'm not actually interested in the sort of ruin porn aspect of Detroit, but that is a major backdrop to everything else that happens in Detroit. And really what I'm usually looking for in a place like Detroit is juxtaposition between something old, something new, something natural, something man-made, something colorful, something drab, you know, those kind of contrasts in both subject and color or layout or anything like that. That's where
I was picking up on that. Yeah, I was digging through your galleries, and I did notice that you have a lot of shots that are like where there seems to be a single point of focus on a subject, like a house on a hill, a van in an underground parking garage, or that when some of your Iceland shots, there's like a van just out in like these like misty like nowhere, right? And at first I was like, oh, he's really focusing on like loneliness or something. There's something about isolation that's really like important to him. But I was like, no, wait, it's about contrast. It's about the context of this thing in this environment. Everyone, because you never get, at least you rarely get really tight on the subject. It's always like pulled back, straight horizon line, thing, and then a whole bunch of stuff around that thing, right?
Yeah.
So like that juxtaposition and that contrast and that what am I trying to say? Context.
Yeah. And a lot of that started when I was living in Chicago, and I was sort of getting into photography as just an artistic pursuit. I was working as a designer, but you know, I went to school for photography, but I never really expected to have a career in photography. The school I went to was primarily journalism, and that, you know, I wasn't going to be a war zone photographer. And, you know, I was a little more boring than that. So So I moved to Chicago, and I was working as a designer. And in Chicago, it's a major metro area, people everywhere. So I was often, like, seeking out places where there just wasn't anybody.
Mm.
And that was sort of tough to find in Chicago. But when you did, it was a really sort of special place and moment. So there were a lot of places where – and frankly, it took a lot of trespassing to find that in that place. But when you did, it was like this amazing reprieve from – the otherwise like chaos of a major city like that. And so a lot of that, so, you know, loneliness is certainly an aspect that can be ascribed to it, but I really see it as, you know, isolation and sort of reprieve.
And quietude.
That was actually the name of just a dummy book that I was putting together for a long time, Quietude, because how I saw it. Not so much like the sadness and dreariness, but really the calmness and the isolation and the solitude.
Well, I have to wonder how much of that comes from your upbringing too, because you grew up in a pretty rural area when you were younger, right? Like, and you know, I've been to that town, and it's flat. It's like Ohio flat, right? Yeah, and like I imagine
it's even flat. It's Michigan flat.
Well, where we live here in Michigan, we've actually got some geography, but I grew up in central Michigan, and like, and it was like in a town where like 25 kids in my class, little house on the prairie kind of deal. And at night it was silent.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And you saw everything in the sky. I got to see Halley's Comet in like a country sky. That was amazing. You know? So like I had wondered like if that like contributes to that voice, right? It was like, you go from that to a cacophonous place.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it definitely did. The horizon was the biggest visual, you know, defining element of every composition, you know, just from seeing it with my eyes. Like that was the grounding element of everywhere I ever was as a kid. You could see, you know, from our house in the country, I could see my neighbors, and my closest neighbors were 3 miles away. You know, it's like, unless there's a tree in the way, you're seeing some serious depth.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely played a lot into it.
Okay. But I'm putting a name on this thing. Is this something that you thought through, or is this something that you just sort of like found yourself doing in terms of creative like growth and development?
As far as, you know, that kind of composition or
right, like in terms of like because that is a common theme that I find in a lot of your photography, is like that horizon line is super prevalent,
which is probably a failing on my part to incorporate, to lean so heavily on that so much.
Well, but Neil Adams, you know, Neil Adams, as he once said, your style is what you do wrong, right? Yeah. So it's like that was like something I noticed as a defining feature of a lot of your photography. It's like everything seems to have like a horizon on it, and that seems to be kind of crucial, and he's not messing with that too much.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to get at here is like, you know, for the cartoonist who's listening and saying like, yeah, this is all well and good, but I got to get a style so I can become marketable. Right. Is this something where you set out like you're 22 years old, you just got your camera and you're like, all right, I'm going to be the horizon guy.
No, it definitely wasn't that commercially beneficial to me. But I, you know, having worked as a designer, you know, I spent a lot of time incorporating text over photographs. So the white space of a photograph was really crucial to whether a photograph was going to be used in a design that I was doing for an album cover or for a brochure or for a website, for anything. Like text placement and the ability for a photograph to allow for that was what made a photo useful or not.
Yeah.
Really what made it used or not. So I wanted my photos used. Yeah. So even if it wasn't conscious that I was like, I'm going to, you know, put my horizon at 1/3 at the bottom every time, that was definitely an innate sort of tendency, but it became really useful as I used my photos in things beyond just here's a photo, look at the composition, wait, it looks like all these other ones, here's a photo, use it in a layout. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where photography overlaps with comic books quite a bit, because the way photography is actually used is very similar to a panel in a comic where, you know, type and copy is going to be an element of that.
Yeah.
And a major element. You have to accommodate for speech bubbles.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can really determine a lot of times how much of that page or that panel is going to be, illustrative versus empty for allowing the text to come in.
And that is a number one thing that I find beginning cartoonists not accommodating for is they don't leave room for sound elements or the text elements of any kind. And then they're like, oh, crap, now I don't have enough room for my dialogue. Well, yeah, you know what? Negative space. It matters.
Right.
But another thing that I'm hearing in everything that you're saying that I think is really cool here is you're talking about – because like one of the things that they tell you in writing and in storytelling in general is brainstorming. Right.
Yep.
Just like keeping a journal, jotting down all of your crap ideas and not thinking too hard about it. Just like let the ideas flow. And I've been doing this 20 years and I still have to remind myself, put the pen on the paper and write things. And even if they're not good, ideas will start to happen through the natural act of just moving your hand and engaging your brain with the paper. And what you're doing is when you said like some language you used, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you said that when you're out shooting, you're not thinking about it, and you don't realize that it's bad until you look at it after the fact, right? So, like, when you're out on the hunt, there's, like, an exploratory thing then. It's like, let's see what we can find. Is that what the mindset is?
Yeah, often. I mean, there's so many different kinds of photography. You know, street photography is nothing but being out on the sidewalk, seeing what happens in front of you. Architectural photography is, you know, completely different. It is an unmoving building, you get to, you know, determine the angles you're going to shoot it from and stuff like that. Studio photography, you're building whatever it is you're going to shoot, or you're lighting whatever it is, you're coaching whatever it is you're going to shoot. So, you know, for my photography work, like commercial work, I'm often having to go somewhere and determine what it is I'm going to shoot, even though I then get to coach that. So, for instance, one of the things I shot for Bloomberg was a welding school in Cincinnati. It was like the biggest welding school in the country. I don't know what that's going to look like when I show up. I do know what their story is and what they're trying to get photos to illustrate that story to be, but I don't know what it looks like till I get there. So that practice of, you know, on my own time when I'm just doing photography for myself, it really is an excuse to be out and looking at things. When I then have to go and do it for a client, you know, it's that same sort of it's more of a confined exploration of like what am I being presented with and what can I make work here, you know, who should I grab to take the photo to get a photo of that would help illustrate the story that has already been in the works, and or what areas of this, you know, enormous building or the school or the city or any of that stuff, where can I pull elements from to kind of bring it all together on a story that I didn't write? I, you know, I didn't determine.
Leading question. that sounds confining to me. That sounds like it would be creatively restricting. I'm an artist. Let me run free. Don't give me all of these arbitrary, you know, prescriptive elements that I have to use in order to make art.
Sure. Well, that would be great if I didn't have to do that ever. But that's why I have my art, and that's why I have somebody else's.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I would have no reason to be there otherwise. So that part of it, that sort of passport into situations that I have no right otherwise to be in. If I just walked in there, I was like, I want to take some pictures of your welding school.
Right,
like, get the hell out of here. No
right,
way.
Right.
But all of a sudden, I'm the guy that everyone's like, you know, trying to accommodate. And like, what do you want to do? You want to bring these things in? You want to move this like 13-ton like welding torch, you know, massive propane thing over? We'll do that. And then we'll get these three people to stand wherever you want. Like, you know, they want to look good. And so I get to like direct this production.
That's pretty cool.
In a place that I would never be in otherwise.
Well, and also, I mean, like, it's like as somebody who does freelance comic book writing, like, I get situations where it's like, okay, it's got to be this many pages, it's got to feature these characters, and it's got to have this theme, right? And have it take place in this specific location, too.
Yeah.
And, like, you can look at that as, like, well, crap, what am I actually doing here? I'm not actually doing any work. I'm just,
right.
like, sort of assembling elements for them. But there's something kind of rewarding about, like, solving that creative problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think like Jackie Chan, like he once said, like when he goes onto a movie set and he's like, he's trying to figure out a fight scene. He's like, okay, what can I use that's never been used in a fight?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, okay, there's a video game cabinet over there. There's a pinball machine over there. I could use that this way.
Right. I'm constantly compared to Jackie Chan.
Well, you were in like a welding school. Right, that's pretty cool.
But I mean, that's another sort of element of like having been a designer for so long. Like I didn't, you know, I was a bit of an illustrator for a while too, but like design is assembling elements to communicate a purpose. Like that, there is no more confining art than being a graphic designer. You have probably a certain page size that's dictated by somebody else. You have words dictated by someone else. You have a certain brand dictated by someone else. You find freedom within those confines because that's the job. That's what you're doing. And so if you're never going to be happy being anything but, you know, this free will and like I get to do whatever I want all the time, well, like good luck.
Right.
But you know, you're almost going to end up more confined by never being put or never being exposed to things that are outside of your comfort zone or never being confronted with, I need you to tell this story in a way that works for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you may work through that, and it might be really difficult, but you might end up having some epiphanies about your own work because of it. Because otherwise, you know, if all I ever did was my own photography and I put it all on a horizontal scrolling thing like my website, you would see that damn horizon line running through. I did that a couple times. I put them all up on the wall as I was, like, sequencing something. I was like, oh, man, this is, like, I hope people think this was on purpose because I have got the same line running, you know, a third of the way down this photo, like all the way down this wall.
Yeah.
And it looks kind of cool pieced together like this, but that is not going to work for many situations.
Right, right. When it does work, though, I tell my students, you know, it's like, take credit for it.
Right.
Definitely take credit.
I totally meant to do it.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. I mean, because that's part of getting other gigs is the braggadocio.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Not to be a jerk about it, but to be like, I know what I'm doing. Yeah.
Yep.
But then again, I look at like your photos from Iceland, your trip to Iceland, and that was a collection where you were doing a lot of like different kinds of shots. There were the horizon shots, but there was also like we're looking down at people bathing.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at up at. There's one shot I remember very clearly. It's of this really impressive waterfall with like a person in the distance, and there's that juxtaposition of size, like so you can get the sense of the grandiose scale, but also it's like that. I'm trying to describe the shot. So you got like the square aspect ratio of the photo, but then the hills that form up to the top of the waterfall like sort of take up the top two-thirds of the image, right?
Yeah.
So there was that particular collection, you were changing a lot of shots and angles. So, okay. Now
I don't think there's a straight line in Iceland for me to, for me to shoot. So.
That's true. They don't have, it is not flat there, not Iceland, in the least.
Yeah.
But when we talk about like architectural photography and then also like when you're talking about like doing these gigs, like how are you thinking about angles in that sense? Like, cause like you talk about like, okay, well when you're doing like the horizon shots, part of it is a reaction to how will this be used. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing shots for a gig where maybe not a lot of text is going to be put on it, maybe it's just going to be put in an article, right? Yeah. Or maybe it's just like an advertising photo where like maybe there's some text at the top and bottom, but it's not going to be like covering the thing. How are you thinking about your shots then? Like how you, like how do angles figure into the storytelling that you're thinking about?
I mean, there is always some subject of every photo, whether it's you know, a skyline or a person or a, you know, piece of food or something. There's always some element that you want people to focus on.
Okay.
And that may play out, you know, horizontally over a wide part of the shot, or it might, you know, be in a certain corner or something. You want to lead people's eyes to it, you know, using perspective and using angles to really force people to look in this corner where to see this little thing that you wouldn't otherwise notice if we were just taking a, you know, far back sort of standing landscape or something. So mm-hmm. So the use of perspective and isolation within the composition of the frame is really important to say this is the thing that you should be noticing here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a lot of times in articles, those photos are being juxtaposed next to each other. And so making every single one of those this amazing standalone composition that goes next to this other one that's composed completely different
yeah.
is not going to work.
Right.
You know, your eyes are going to start to uncross because you got one leading you to this little guy over here, but then you got this other one that's going up and to the right and all this stuff. So
yeah.
So you got to kind of, you know, and after a while, you start to just be able to tell, like, you know, what the photo editor is probably going to do. And, you know, you give them the photos that you think that you really want them to use, and then you give them a bunch of crap that you know they're not going to choose. And you can kind of see how this is going to
come together. I totally do the exact same thing in freelance illustration.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you give them like three duds like so that they'll go in the direction that you want. Yep. Yeah, yeah. That's an awesome trick.
Yeah.
There's a tip for you watching.
You know, but some, I think the common term is always like a hairy arm in the corner of it. It's like, well, all these look great, but let's get the one without the hairy arms. Yes. That's the one that I wanted.
I totally grabbed that for the tease. hairy arm at the corner. But, man. Okay. I'm gonna say this. I'm going to see what kind of emotional reaction you get to it, see if you get the same one that I do. So I go out with my family, my in-laws, and they go, hey, Jersey, there's an impressive thing. Go stand next to the thing. Click.
Yep.
You're centered in the shot, right? And I go, oh, this is the worst kind of photography ever because this is just like evidence that I was there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like artful. It's not interesting. And then so like I take this as a serious charge to not let my students get away with that, right? So like when they go, like, here's panel one. Characters in the center, straight on shots, you know, because I didn't think about what the shot means.
Yeah.
Right? Like what you're describing is what cartoonists should be doing, is thinking about the relationship between all these images. And I bet as somebody who thinks about this really hard, you can see it in a comic when it's not being thought through.
Definitely. I mean, if you get through six pages of a comic and the frame has not changed very much, the composition, the order of the people talking or the mm-hmm. or, you know, the direction of the room that we're facing, like I'm getting bored quick.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how compelling the story is, if you're not using the visual storytelling along with the, you know, verbal or written storytelling, then you're missing half the point of the whole thing. So if same deal with the photos, like I actually have lots of photos where the subject is dead center and that's actually kind of a conscious choice sometimes to say, like, I know that this is how everybody would have shot this thing, but that the point here is that person and the surroundings really matter for those kind of shots.
I'm thinking there's one on your website of a Captain America shirt.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like dead center in the shot, but it's like all like damaged and it's in this pile of mud.
Yeah.
And like the texture and the arrangement of the shot, the structure of the stuff around it is what makes the image of this Captain America shirt
interesting. Yeah, and that one, you know, if I had shot that in sort of a traditionally like rule of thirds sort of way where I'm like, you know, putting it off to the side, trying to make it look cool, that's not the point. The point of this was that this is not cool. This is this busted old shirt sitting on the side of a cliff somewhere, like in the middle of Minnesota. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's. I'm not trying to make this look like a slick scenario.
Yeah.
This is actually like I found this thing that shouldn't be here, and so I'm putting it right in the center to say, does this make you feel weird that there is this thing? This is otherwise like a this beautiful national park on Lake Superior that everything should be serene and picturesque, and now there's this like faded Captain America shirt. And what's that say both, you know, about America, because obviously it says Captain America on it. Like
commercialism,
wastefulness, right? And littering, and you know, how pretty could it be if we're going to interact with it and all that stuff.
So. And it's a crass commercial image of what we consider to be our ideals.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah.
And it's faded. I mean, so many things.
Right. Right. So you are thinking about clarity a lot.
Yeah.
When you're doing this. So like how. Have you ever had situations where clarity trumps cleverness for you in your work? Like, I think that you just described that, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm almost always more drawn to photos of a subject, not interesting photos that happen to have a subject in them. Like,
oh, God, you know, there's, that's a great way to say it.
There's a lot of there's amazing photographers that make incredibly slick imagery that is perfectly applicable for what they're shooting. They're shooting stuff that looks great and it feels amazing and it's meant to like evoke a good feeling from you.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm drawn to. You know, I'm not trying to make anyone feel better through my photography. I am actually just saying, look at what we're doing to this place.
Yeah.
You know, good or bad. Like,
yeah.
We did this. And so most like I love landscape photography, but I get really bored with my own landscape photography if there's not something else to it besides just I was at this place that looked amazing.
Yeah.
And so if there's not some element of our human interaction with that environment, then it's not a great photo for me.
Yeah. A lot of your photos of environments I noticed feature some kind of quirky object.
Yeah.
Right? There'll be like a house that looks like this was once a really nice house, but it's kind of fallen into disrepair. Maybe people are still living in it and like the address is spray painted on the side of the house.
Yeah.
Right? Everything else is like beautiful and pristine. Then there's this one weird thing just jutting out saying like humanity. Right?
Yep. And so the composition, going back to your question about sort of composition of that stuff, I'm not trying to make a beautiful photo of this derelict looking thing. I really am purposely presenting it as this is something you usually ignore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would otherwise pass this by and not think twice about it because you want to look at the pretty stuff behind it.
Yeah.
But this is here, so look at it. So putting that, for those reasons, putting that central when otherwise, you know, most photography books would say, you know, put it in the corner, like put the subject in the corner. Maybe, you know, that's a good compositional tool, mm-hmm. but it's also, there's a storytelling aspect to putting something dead center. You are saying this is the thing you should be noticing.
Yeah.
And the stuff around it is ancillary to that. Like, it's a supporting character, but this is the point of what I just shot.
Well, this is completely analogous to something that cartoonists, friends of mine, have been saying for the last couple of years, is how one of the neat things that's happened in the last 10 years in comics, as web comics has come more to fruition, and also is the manga generation. All the girls and boys who read manga like 10, 15 years ago are now becoming adults and making comics. There's so much more variety of visual style that it almost feels like the appealing nature of the storytelling is now separate from the quality of the illustration.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We're finally at a point where you don't have to draw awesome mm-hmm. to tell good comic storytelling as long as you know how to tell a really good story.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can get so bewildered by fancy tricks and composition, like the rule of thirds.
Right.
Rule is in there, right? Like you obey this thing. Or if you're going to break it very cleverly like Picasso would, right? There's a lot of gravity put on things like that, right? Sometimes the real rule is like, are you really trying to tell a story here?
Yeah.
Or are you just trying to show everybody like your flair for
exactly, for
visuals, right?
Yeah, the slickness of things sometimes trumps the mm-hmm. point. And there's lots of great comic artists and photographers who are incredibly slick artists.
Yeah.
And the stuff is like impressive as hell.
Yeah.
Like I wish I could, you know, do that sometimes. But it's also sometimes completely boring.
Right, right. Yeah, that's the weird thing. Like,
I mean, we're barraged with imagery now
mm-hmm.
in our world, online, in books, everything. I mean, we live in such a lush, rich, imagery-filled world now that, like, a really slick-looking photo is as easily dismissed as anything as that derelict house. So, if you know, it's really, you've really got to sort of toe the line between, like, am I just making the coolest looking thing, or am I making this with a purpose?
I'm going to say like a terrible buzzword, but it sounds like you're kind of talking about authenticity a little bit.
Or, yeah.
Honesty.
Or earnestism.
Earnestism. Yes, that's a conversation we've been having for a long time now, is when does irony become earnestness?
Break through the ironic floor back into being earnest.
And becoming an earnester. I think that's I accidentally said earnster once. I'm like, no, that's a different thing altogether. Okay, well, you know what? We're coming up on the point when we should be doing book recommendations, but I want to make sure that is there anything that you want to point people at of your own stuff? Like anything that you're doing, any appearances, any shows, anything that you're doing that you want people to pay extra special attention to in the coming weeks?
I mean, just follow me on Instagram.
Okay.
That's all I ever ask.
And you do shoot all those Instagram photos with your phone, right?
No.
Is that
Why?
A rule?
Who cares?
I know, but like I didn't realize until you made a joke about it on Twitter. I didn't realize that was like an actual thing. Like,
oh, yeah. People get real, real anal about that.
Like, really?
I mean, some people do, some people don't. Yeah. I mean, I see it as just another medium, and there are some photos that whatever camera I'm taking it on, they're still mostly appropriate for something like Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it as like somehow less than putting on my website. That's where, you know, most of my audience is, like,
yeah,
you know, Tumblr or Instagram. That's where people are looking at. The people looking at my portfolio are photo editors that maybe are looking at it when they have a story that they need shot.
Yeah.
The people who are following my, you know, my story or whatever, my work, mm-hmm. they're doing it on these places where if I tried to make a rule that, you know, I'm only ever going to put the photos from my phone up there, it's like that's limiting 95% of the photos that I would never put anywhere else anyways. So why
right.
wouldn't I put some of them up there if it is my, like, you know, my output?
Well, no, yeah. I mean, that
should you not be putting drawings on there because you didn't
exactly
take them with your, you know.
That's exactly it, right? It's like, yeah, some of the photos that I post are of, like, I pointed them my phone camera at my sketchbook.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, it's stuff I drew digitally,
right?
So then I'm hosting a webcomic on Instagram. Like, Boulder and Fleet is on Instagram, right? So it's like, yeah, that was the first thing I thought. I was like, well, am I breaking a rule, like an unofficial rule with this thing?
Yeah, I think some people just, they like to have the rules, which is, you know, it's fine. If you have that scenario set up and you're thriving within that, awesome.
Yeah.
I still have an old iPhone. It's not that great. Like, I have a much better camera that I actually like shooting with.
Uh-huh.
I want to show people those photos.
What's your favorite camera right now?
I mean, actually right now, the Fuji X100T. It's a great little rangefinder that has completely manual dials for aperture, shutter, and focus, but it's still a really good digital camera. It's very small. I have it in my bag. I take it everywhere. It's the in between my phone, which is still probably what I shoot everything on. Because I got a kid, you know. I was like,
yeah,
I got a lot of photos to take. but you know, my main camera is like a Canon 5D3 with this big honking lens on it and a battery grip and all this stuff. This Fuji sort of fits right in between those and takes really amazing raw images, but has all the sort of manual controls that I used to have. You know, I shot a Hasselblad right up until I was shooting with a Canon, and I mean, there was nothing automatic. There's no battery in it, so it was completely manual, and so I'm still very used to.
Is that one of those like those weapons grade ones where it's like completely made of metal and it weighs like 16, 17 pounds?
It's the one they took on the space shuttle.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Not the one.
Right, but actually, it's the same model.
Quick aside, yeah. I was living in Berkeley for a while and I sold my computer on Craigslist. And the guy that bought my computer on Craigslist was a guy who worked at the space program during the Apollo mission. He developed the timestamp for the film. It was an attachment that went on the bottom of the Hasselblads that went up and would actually put the time on the film. It shine a little light like point and shoots do now did for a long time.
Yeah.
He was one of the first ones to develop how to do that on the film in the Hasselblads that the astronauts use.
How cool is that?
Yeah. He was a crackpot otherwise. But pretty cool for that reason.
a lot of people came out of the other end of the space program a little, weird.
It fried some people, I think. some serious burnout.
Yeah, there's a very intense period. So, okay, cool. Well, if we'll follow you on Instagram, Peter Baker on Instagram. I agree. The posting natively on social media is like the only, like, that's the blog now, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's all arbitrary. Like, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that Instagram was on a phone that had a camera, mm-hmm. nobody would even think twice about it. It's like, what am I going to post to Tumblr then? Only stuff that I made on my computer? You know, like,
yeah.
I don't have time for all these rules.
People like to make lots of rules, but you also brought books that you're reading right now. So, yeah. Like, I would be curious to see what a professional photographer and designer is reading. What is he responding to?
Well, the first one is a photography book. I just wanted to bring this because Alex Soth is, you know, probably my biggest photography influence. This was the guy I mentioned earlier that shoots amazing, you know, poetic landscapes and portraits with an enormous camera that takes, you know, half hour, 45 minutes to, like, set up, get the photos. So by the time he's taken the photo, his subject, whoever he is convinced to hang out for that long, is in such a relaxed state of mind that they are – the photos that he's capturing of them are as true to realistic, authentic scenarios you're going to find. So this is sort of his compendium, Alex Soth, From Here to There. Very cool book. Sleeping by the Mississippi was the book that sort of blew him up. He's one of the photographers who really was at the beginning of the book resurgence in photography. So he does make enormous framed gallery prints and has amazing exhibitions, but his artistic output is primarily through books. Mm. And he has a very, very purposeful thread throughout his stories.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, very cool. I just started reading WYSIWYG, which is partly for my other job as a creative director at a internet security company. Hacking culture is a very big deal to us. So this is sort of a combination of five real stories about actually true life hackers who, you know, Kevin Mitnick is part of the element of this guy. But the one guy, the serial hacker in this book, is sort of a conglomerate of a few different true stories. And very, very cool, really nice, simple sort of Chris Ware style illustration.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, he's like somewhere between Daniel Clowes and Chris Ware.
Yeah,
right.
A little more illustrative than, or a little more detailed than Chris Ware, but
yeah,
cool stuff.
Yeah, and this is from Top Shelf, WYSIWYG,
and Portrait it's, of a Serial Mac SE cover, which is just
that's pretty
kinda,
great.
Kind of rad.
That is pretty good design. I mean, this is the thing. Like, this tells you what to expect. Right. That's a great cover, and then plus with like the old timey like 1996 Photoshop
Mac Paint.
Was that Mac Paint?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's been so long since I've seen it. Oh, and then you got, like, some more traditional stuff here.
Yeah, so Letter 44 was a really cool one that I read recently. You know, I don't keep up enough on sort of monthly releases. So often I'm going to Baltimore Midnight and talking to Curtis or Christian. They're like, what do I got to read right now? Mm-hmm. And Christian there recommended this. Yeah, you know. They're really great about sort of like what are you into, and one of the things that I've always loved in comic books is the what ifs or the else worlds. Yeah. It's sort of like we have a story, but this is a completely different take on this thing that you already know. Because I can't keep up with the Avengers, you know, ongoing stories. Mm-hmm. But I love this sort of mini series of like, well, what if it wasn't like that? You know, what if Silver Surfer got the Infinity Gauntlet or something like that?
Yeah.
So Letter 44 is a really cool cool book. It is an ongoing one, but I just got the first volume of it. It was the story of the president, modern-day president, who took over for a sort of George Bush type and, you know, railed against all the policies of going to war and stuff. There was an Iraq and Afghanistan war. But then when he got into office, there's this letter waiting on the Oval Office desk telling him that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were a cover-up for spending money on the space program because they found aliens near Jupiter. And so everything that he had been railing against, now he has to keep going too. So it's sort of this great, like, story of, you know, sort of true socio-political dynamics of things while also having this 3-year space program to go out and just see what's going on by Jupiter. So the story is both about the president trying to keep this thing going and tell everybody why he's not doing what he said he was going to do for so long, and the deep space mission that's going out to see it. So, very cool.
Very cool. Well, and it just sounds like just a thing to like kind of raise your goose flesh, considering the whole Ceres thing that's going on right now. The planet Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, like with the two weird lights on it.
Yep.
We still don't know what that is, right?
But maybe we do. and the other one, I mean, the other book I brought, if anybody hasn't already read this a dozen
There's
times,
a lot of people who
crazy.
Haven't read it. But
The Infinity Gauntlet is still by far my favorite series. It's only 6 issues. The rest of them, Infinity War, Infinity Crusade, those kind of fell off a bit. But Infinity Gauntlet was, I mean, part of it was just when this was coming out, this was like my prime comic reading time. And it was just like the mix of like cosmic Marvel with this sort of, getting into the concepts of being able to control reality and the soul and time. I mean, it was just – I soaked it up. It was
George Perez too, wasn't it?
George Perez. Ron Lim took over after the 4th issue.
That's right.
I mean, he did all the covers for all 6. George Perez did the artwork, and then Ron Lim – I mean, both those guys, they were the – like when I was copying comics, those were the ones I was copying.
Oh, yeah.
And this is actually a great example of composition and stuff. There are so many pages in here where big pullbacks to large scale space stuff. I mean, this was cosmic Marvel at its best. This blew my mind. There's just one spread in here where it pulls back and you see all the Eternals and chaos. Oh, I mean, chaos and order, like personifying chaos and order as these two, like the dichotomy of that stuff. Love and hate were people.
Yeah,
I mean that I was like in 8th grade or something when this came out. I mean, it was like trying mushrooms for the first time. I was like, you got to be kidding me. These are people that I can talk to? No way.
And death is like Thanos is like his crush.
Yeah, yeah. It was unreal.
So, and the thing about Perez's work, I mean, like, and I just had a former student of mine come to town, and she was like, I need to go to the vault. Because you schooled me in a lot of things, but you never schooled me in what my history is, right? Like, who are the artists who I need to know of to know my people's history? And I'm like, okay, well, Kirby, Kirby. And she's like, all right, you're not old enough yet. Like, Kirby's like beer. Like, when you first have it, you're like, this is gross. Why would anybody drink this? And then, like, you get to be, like, a little bit older. You're like, hey, this is amazing. Where's this been all my life? But the next one, I was like, you need to read Perez.
Yeah.
You need to read Perez's Infinity Gauntlet, Crisis on Infinite Earths. And then also, have you read JLA versus Avengers?
No, I should. If anything, George Perez, I'll take.
It's all of that. But it's also because like all the like cosmic Marvels in it.
Yeah.
But it's this Busiek wrote it, and he does this wonderful analysis of how the two universes feel through the eyes of the person from the other universe.
Yeah.
So Superman goes to the Marvel U, and he's like, "How come these heroes can't hold their stuff together? All their people hate them. All the citizens hate their heroes. This is stupid. You guys don't know. You can clean up your mess, right?" And then Captain America comes to the DCU, and he's like, those heroes have statues made to them. They're clearly tyrants. They've got their people terrified of them, right? And so, like, you get Quicksilver goes to the DCU, and he's like, in Central City, the people love the Flash, and like, I'm a mutant, and people chase me around with stakes and knives.
Yeah.
So it has that plus all the cosmic stuff in it. Right. It's pretty good.
And I'll say I was after. After the Avengers movie came out and Thanos showed up at the end. I mean,
I remember I was there. It was like coffee the next week. You're like, did you see? Yeah.
And
it's pretty great.
So I picked up a bunch of Avengers books from like the year prior and stuff. And the new Avengers is almost all, I mean, it's like hyper cosmic. It's like, going back to the architects of the universe and stuff like that. But the way, going back to the composition and storytelling and stuff, like, it's really confusing what they're talking about. They do not – I mean, they're using terms that – I don't know if I just missed that issue. But the way they're talking about this stuff is, like, this is – it's not scientific, so it's not like it's heady.
Right.
But it's just really obtuse, and the way they lay it out, it's just maybe there's too many things going on. That's what I love about the Infinity Gauntlet. It's, like, it's so clear what's happening page by page, even though – you're talking about concepts like having a gem that can control reality and having time, collapse and layer itself and like bend back. I mean, like enormously complicated aspects or concepts of things, right. But it's so clear and
it's accessible.
So well. It's super accessible,
right? Yeah, I mean, like that was a rule back then: is that every comic is somebody's first. So we have to make this that the entry, the cost of entry is really low, yeah. And it feels like, especially in the last 15 years, comics has gotten direct market. Comic store comics, monthlies, have gotten less so,
yeah,
right? Like the price of entry is a little bit higher.
I don't know if they just expect that you are reading them all or because they have so many versions of the Avenger or versions of every team.
That's a whole other discussion, yeah. But, I mean, it's telling that – and I actually applaud DC for this, but it's telling that they released a book explaining all of their core graphic novels that are like the must-read. Here are like the 12 most important graphic novels we've done, and these are the entry points in the DCU. The fact that they have to give you – you know, a triple A triptych in order to like navigate their stories is a telling thing. Right. So did I just date myself by talking about triptychs? All right. Well, I want to respect your time, Pete. But man, I'm so glad we finally did this.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, cool. So peterbaker.net, PTRBKR on Twitter.
Yeah. I got on Twitter when it was cool to take all the vowels out of stuff.
I got out there early enough.
Still
to get
says
my first
it though,
name.
Peter Baker.
But I'm the douchiest of all though, because I got just my first name on Twitter. That's pretty bad.
Yeah. But I mean, how many other jerseys?
There's actually quite a few, believe it or not. But you know about the base thing, right?
Yeah,
yeah. So like, he's got Jersey Droz. So some people accidentally tag him all the time.
That's right. That's right.
But anyway, so people should follow you up on Instagram, Peter Baker on Instagram. And this show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG109. If you enjoyed this discussion, if you got something out of this, if you at least had fun, a great thing you could do is go to iTunes and give it a star review. You don't have to write a review, just however many stars you think that this episode deserves. If you're watching it on YouTube, give it a thumbs up. That helps more people find the show. And the more people who find the show, follow the show, the more I can lean on the library to let me do more interesting things with the show. Speaking of the library, thank you to Eric Closter and Matt Dubay in the control room for putting the show on, for giving me the space to do this, and wiring all the octopus tentacles into the big machine to let me do this thing. Thank you for downloading, listening, and watching. Until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.